I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, the House Judiciary Committee held an impeachment inquiry hearing featuring four law professors: Stanford's Pamela Karlan, Harvard's Noah Feldman, UNC's Michael Gerhardt, and George Washington's Jonathan Turley. At issue was the U.S. Constitution and what guidance it provided to the committee about whether President Trump violated the public trust and deserved to be impeached when he conditioned military funding for Ukraine on its president finding dirt on Joe Biden, a political rival. The three witnesses for the Democrats all said yes, while Turley said there wasn't enough information and enough time to make an informed judgment about impeachment. The White House has refused to cooperate with the House request for documents and its subpoenas. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made this announcement just a few minutes ago.
Sadly, but with confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders, and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment. I commend our committee chairs and our members for their somber approach to actions which I wish the president had not made necessary.
Let me introduce our two guests joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. David S. Cohen, he's a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, where he teaches constitutional law and related topics. David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington is Robert Tsai. He's a professor of constitutional law at American University and an expert on the presidency. He's written a number of books about FDR, LBJ, Obama, and Trump. His latest book is Practical Equality, Forging Justice in a Divided Nation. And Robert Tsai, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Greetings, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I do want to just mark this moment. This is really the fourth time in U.S. history when a president has faced impeachment, and there's much to discuss. But I just want to give each of you a chance, and I'll start with you, Robert, about the significance of Pelosi's announcement just about an hour ago, where she really accused the president of the abuse of power.
I think this is a historic moment, as you pointed out just now. This sort of thing is not part of our regular politics, and it shouldn't be. And to this point, the impeachment proceedings has, on the one hand, tried to be a very sober process, but on the other, there have been efforts to sort of gum it up, to sort of push storylines that suggest that somehow the entire proceedings have been illegitimate. And so I think the Democrats in particular have a vested interest in trying to remind people that this is a rare event and that we should all take this very seriously.
David, it's interesting because Nancy Pelosi was reluctant and until just a month or so ago, really reluctant to pursue impeachment proceedings.
I don't think she wanted to be perceived as doing it for political reasons. She was one of the last Democrats to really be convinced that this was necessary. It really took this Ukraine story and none of the other stories that came out before it, because she understands that this is one of the most serious jobs that the members of Congress have under the Constitution. This and declaring war might be the most serious things they do, and it's not to be done lightly. And so she waited until this pushed her over the edge.
Robert, what does her announcement mean? I mean, we had the Intelligence Committee hearings. We also had the hearings yesterday in the Judiciary Committee. Her announcement, does that fast-track the process? What happens next?
I think what it does is it tells all Americans that this train is leaving the station, that anyone who has any doubts up to this point that impeachment would not happen, that you should put those thoughts to rest. Those articles will be drafted. They will be coming out of House Judiciary momentarily. And there will be, from all the evidence that we can see so far, multiple counts levied against the President of the United States.
You said momentarily. You mean even as we speak, Robert?
Well, yes, in a way. I mean, I think these conversations have been going on for a while behind the scenes, right? And the major debate behind the scenes among the members of the House Judiciary are just how many articles to draft. There are a number of progressive Democrats, for example, who believe that there should be four or five counts, including things like the Emoluments Clause violations from day one. So I think that these conversations are ongoing, and we'll see just how these things sort of shake out. But yes, they're ongoing, and they'll be, I think, coming in days.
In days. It looks like you want to add something, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's been reports that the House might do this before Christmas, right at the end of December leading into Christmas. And the Senate released their calendar for 2020, and there's a big blank for January. And I think that they are expecting to have a trial in the Senate. Not sure how long that'll last, but that January might be the month we see a Senate trial.
I do want to talk about yesterday's Judiciary Committee hearing, and just let me put this out there, and I'll start with you, Robert. If President Trump pressured Ukraine for his own personal gain using military aid as either a carrot or a stick, and that sort of is the most boiled-down version, I think, of what the Democrats are really alleging here, is that impeachable?
I think it is, and one of the things that if you watched the hearings yesterday or read snippets of, about what happened, the impression that you've got to come away with is that each of the witnesses, including Professor Turley, who cautioned the Democrats running the process not to work too quickly, he really didn't deny the basic point that the first three experts made, which is that if, in fact, there is a finding that the president did what you said, demanded or conditioned certain things of value on the things that have been described, that this rises the level of high crimes and misdemeanor. It might even be bribery, something that is specifically mentioned in the Constitution as a grounds for impeachment.
It's interesting, though, David, from the Republican side, again, sort of speaking as a group of people, the consensus seems to be that this might have been bad but not impeachable, that we don't have enough information to decide whether this is impeachable or not. Everything is kind of secondhand, or that Ukraine and not Russia really meddled in the election of 2016. I wonder if the Republicans have backed themselves into a corner.
Their defenses have changed wildly. First, nothing happened. Then it happened and it was a joke. Then it happened and it was serious, but it's not a big deal. Now it's because Ukraine was meddling with the 2016 election and not Russia. We don't know exactly what the defense is going to be when it gets to a debate on the House floor or a trial. But if yesterday's any indication, there might be procedural objections about we need to do more fact-finding. But they really, I mean, the evidence is out there. We have the president's own words. We have the president's own transcript or report of a phone call. We have the president's advisors with their statements. And then we have all the testimony from the people in the last couple of weeks. The testimony, I think, is pretty damning, and that this is pretty clearly high crimes and misdemeanors and possibly bribery. And I think the House is going to find that very clearly soon enough.
Let me play from the opening statement from Harvard Law Professor Noah Feldman. This, of course, was yesterday. He opened the round of testimony saying he believed President Trump's actions constituted high crimes and misdemeanors and are therefore impeachable. It's about a minute. Let's give it a listen.
Let me begin by stating my conclusions. The framers provided for the impeachment of the president because they feared that the president might abuse the power of his office for personal benefit, to corrupt the electoral process and ensure his reelection, or to subvert the national security of the United States. High crimes and misdemeanors are abuses of power and of public trust connected to the office of the presidency. On the basis of the testimony and the evidence before the House, President Trump has committed impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors by corruptly abusing the office of the presidency. Specifically, President Trump has abused his office by corruptly soliciting President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine to announce investigations of his political rivals in order to gain personal advantage, including in the 2020 presidential election.
Robert, let me go to you and go back to the founders. They did talk about treason and bribery as a reason for impeachment, but high crimes and misdemeanors is a rather looser use of words in describing some kind of misdeeds.
It is looser. It was intended to be looser, but we shouldn't think of it as so malleable that it has no content whatsoever. I think that the framers really did think about this in a very hard way. On the one hand, there were some people who thought that the president should never be impeachable. And then others, those who won the day, argued that the president cannot be like a king, had to be someone who followed the rule of law, was not above it. And I thought that Professor Feldman's testimony did a very nice job of beginning a kind of a civic lesson for all Americans and trying to answer a question that most Americans must have, which is, look, there's this election that's just right around the corner. Why are we even bothering going through this process? And what Professor Feldman reminds us is that the framers themselves ask themselves this question, right? Mm-hmm. And the answer that they came up with was that we needed impeachment as an additional remedy, even when there was an election around the corner. Why? Because of the risk that a president could, and this is a language that Professor Feldman emphasizes and one that's used by the framers, could act corruptly with a corrupt motive to use the powers of the office of the presidency that no other person in the world has to gain an advantage in his reelection efforts. There would be no other remedy to deal with this sort of problem. There was one of the framers who got a lot of action today, someone that probably most people didn't has never heard of. That's William Davey of North Carolina.
Yeah, never heard of the guy.
Exactly. And the great quote that comes from Mr. Davey is this concern that others shared, that if impeachment was not an additional remedy to reelection, then a president might be able to spare no effort or means whatever to get himself reelected. And this was a prospect that chilled all of the framers.
David, let me go back to you. I'm looking at the clock. You're about a minute before our first break here. But that has been an argument from the Republicans saying, look, we've got an election, you know, less than a year away. Let the voters decide rather than intervening with impeachment.
I think Professor Carlin yesterday really spoke well to this when she linked the issues of impeachment, bribery, treason, and high crimes and misdemeanors to the fundamental nature of a democracy, which is that we don't want the president interfering with elections, let alone asking a foreign power to interfere with an election. That's one of the things the framers were keenly aware of with our new fledgling experiment in democracy. They didn't want other countries to try and interfere with this. Here we are 220 years later, and that's exactly what we have happening. And so if we don't do anything now, the risk is that the 2020 election will be compromised. And then who knows what after that?
Let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's David S. Cohen. He's a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, teaches constitutional law. Robert Tsai joining us from the NPR studios in Washington. He's a professor of constitutional law at American University, talking about yesterday's testimony at the House Judiciary Committee featuring four law professors. That's right, four law professors. We've got two joining us today in Radio Times. What we learned, of course, Nancy Pelosi's announcement just about an hour ago that impeachment is now official. 1-888-477-9499, Radio Times at WHYY.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with two law professors, Robert Tsai and David S. Cohen, about what we learned yesterday when the House Judiciary Committee heard from four law professors about the impeachment of President Trump. And just about an hour ago, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made it official. The impeachment proceedings is going forward. David, let me pick up on something that you said, because back in 2016, candidate Trump said a number of things, including Russia, if you are listening, inviting them to hack Hillary's emails. As president, he has tried to put pressure on the president of Ukraine to investigate a political rival. What is the difference?
I mean, they're both problematic, very problematic. I mean, when he was a candidate asking another country to interfere in the election, that was bad enough. It's possibly illegal and it's been investigated and should be, we should really understand exactly what happened. I mean, that was the basis, part of the basis of the Mueller report. But when you have an actual president instead of a candidate, a president who can control, say, foreign aid or control who visits the White House or announcements that are made about who's an ally and who's not, that's a whole different ballgame because foreign presidents are going to care a lot more about what our actual president is saying and wants to happen rather than a candidate who may or may not ever become president.
Robert, the president has said, in a nutshell, that I'm the president, I can do what I want. What does the Constitution say about that?
He's wrong about that. He can't do whatever he wants. Throughout the Constitution, there are many provisions that tell us that the framers themselves were very worried about someone who might come into office, speak like a demagogue, and then try to behave like a king. And I think you're right that if we think about this particular president's failings, if you will, the reasons he often gives for doing what he does are A, I can do whatever I want, as you suggested, or B, I can do X power. That means I can use that power in any way I want. It's a sort of a variation on the first. And I think one of the things about the testimony yesterday, which is quite striking, is that they were pushing back against both of these kinds of arguments. And just to go back to Professor Carlin's testimony, I thought David was absolutely right about how she linked the president's actions to kind of described it as a threat to democracy today. The language she used, and I'm quoting from her, is that she saw the president as doubling down on something that he had already done in the previous election. And to Professor Carlin, this kind of lack of restraint, this continued pattern of action, magnified an existing distortion of America's democracy. And I think this is a very powerful way of thinking about, you know, what the stakes are in this impeachment.
Do you want to add something, and then we'll play that clip that you both have referenced?
Yeah, that comment from President Trump is probably one of the most un-American things a president could possibly say. The entire point of our revolution and starting a new country was to get away from a king who could do whatever he wanted. The framers were keenly aware of that. They wanted to avoid a repeat of that. Certainly, they gave the president enormous powers, but far from unlimited powers. For President Trump to say that, I mean, I don't think he's ever gotten out of the mindset of a CEO of a closely held corporation where he could do whatever he want, bound by law, but no one controlled him. He was in charge. He thinks he can do the same thing as the president, and like I said, that's un-American.
Isn't that a version of what Nixon said?
Yeah, but I don't think Nixon's even went as far as President Trump has gone here.
Let me play. This is Stanford Law Professor Pamela Carlin. This is from yesterday's testimony, part of her opening statement. I should add that she inserted a rebuttal to Republican ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, Doug Collins, who had insinuated earlier that Professor Carlin had not read the House's impeachment report. Let's hear what she had to say. And again, it's about a minute.
That everything I know about our Constitution and its values and my review of the evidentiary record, and here, Mr. Collins, I would like to say to you, sir, that I read transcripts of every one of the witnesses who appeared in the live hearing because I would not speak about these things without reviewing the facts. So I'm insulted by the suggestion that as a law professor, I don't care about those facts. But everything I read on those occasions tells me that when President Trump invited, indeed demanded, foreign involvement in our upcoming election, he struck at the very heart of what makes this a republic to which we pledge allegiance. That demand, as Professor Feldman just explained, constituted an abuse of power. Indeed, as I want to explain in my testimony, drawing a foreign government into our elections is an especially serious abuse of power because it undermines democracy itself.
Robert, why did the founders so fear foreign intervention?
I think this is complicated, but it's absolutely true that they feared foreign intervention. In part, it's because we had a much more fluid notion of nationhood. As a young nation, we were essentially being governed, and our form of government was being created by foreigners themselves, right? People born elsewhere. And this created a certain amount of sort of cultural and political anxiety about who is authentically American and what metrics should we use to define sort of true patriotism. Now, we continue to have those debates today, but I think that's one sort of cultural and political source of this. The other source, I think, of their concern, more specific one, is that they were all sort of educated in a very classical way, and they'd all read about Rome and the Greek city states, and they very much had internalized the sense that a number of very successful civilizations had fallen in part because of inability to deal with, you know, the risk of foreign influence.
David, it's interesting. I mean, we say that no one is above the law, including the president, but he does feel outside the law, if you know what I mean, and maybe for good reasons, because you don't necessarily want people, you know, charging a president with all sorts of nefarious and unsupported crimes.
So we've never had a president who's been officially charged with criminal behavior. There are wide disagreement among constitutional scholars about whether a president can be charged with crimes while in office. I personally think a president can for a serious enough crime, but there are certainly many who disagree with that. But what we do know is that Congress has a lot of powers to try and check the president, including investigations, well short of impeachment. President Trump has tried to thwart investigations. They have oversight, and he's thwarted that. And now they're trying to use their constitutionally empowered impeachment power, and he's trying to thwart that. So if it seems like the president is outside the law, it's because this president is creating that sense that I am indeed outside the law, outside the Constitution, and I think he truly does believe he can do whatever he wants. And unfortunately, with our system of government, with enough members of the House and the Senate who agree with him, he could get away with it.
Robert, the White House has made no bones about the fact that they will not cooperate with whatever House committee is investigating impeachment. Is that unprecedented? And can they do that?
I think it is unprecedented. And this is something where there was a difference in the testimony of the witnesses yesterday, a difference that was really embodied in the testimony of Professor Gerhardt on the one hand, and Professor Turley on the other. If you listen to Professor Turley, you know, the point that he wanted to raise was, look, a president does have some legitimate reasons for claiming privilege, and in particular, the arguments for privilege of some sort or immunity is strongest when we're dealing with the president's kind of closest advisors. And there are a lot of reasons for this, but the main one given is that a president should be able to enjoy some space for difficult conversations, we want him to gain advice from experts, free from the kind of constant interference that that accountability of a deep sense would create. But on the other hand, and this is something that I think Professor Gerhardt did a very good job with, what he pointed out was that if we looked at the absolute scale of resistance by this particular president's administration, it really does seem like it's unprecedented. One of the things that Professor Gerhardt pointed out was that both President Clinton and President Nixon allowed his people to testify, including President Nixon's chief of staff and counsel. They cooperated with subpoenas for documents, And this stands in sharp contrast with the behavior of this particular administration, right? They won't even comply with subpoenas for paperwork. And this is really, I think, a big point of difference here.
And that's Robert Tsai, again, a professor of constitutional law at American University. David S. Cohen with us as well, and he teaches constitutional law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Our own law professors talking about what happened yesterday in the House of Representatives, the Judiciary Committee. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play another clip, and then, David, I'll give you a chance to weigh in. And this is the third of four of the law professors yesterday. This is Jonathan Turley. This is part of his opening statement. He was the one dissenter among the group of professors saying that he thinks impeaching the president would be wrong. Let's give it a listen.
It's wrong because this is not how you impeach an American president. This case is not a case of the unknowable. It's a case of the peripheral. We have a record of conflicts, defenses that have not been fully considered, unsubpoenaed witness with material evidence. To impeach a president on this record would expose every future president to the same type of inchoate impeachment.
David, he's saying we need more evidence, we need more people to testify, we need more documents, we need more time. Does that hold water?
I don't think so. I think it's important, as Robert has already said, Professor Turley yesterday did not say that he didn't think the allegations rise to the level of impeachable conduct. His argument really was that we don't know enough yet. That doesn't really land for me in the sense that we have Trump's direct words, we have his transcript, we have testimony from people who talked with him. And the reason we don't have some of the direct evidence that I think Professor Turley seemed to want, if you take him at his words at face value, is because President Trump has directed those people not to testify and has withheld the documents that we were just talking about. So there might be more information that we could find out. But the reason we don't have that information is because President Trump is stonewalling the entire situation, so we don't have this information. The Congress is, the House of Representatives has asked for this information. They have a right to it under their constitutional powers, and the president is keeping that information from them. That is the obstruction of justice charge that is probably going to be a part of the impeachment process.
Robert, that raises questions about the courts. I mean, where are the courts in this whole process if we're talking about this balance of powers?
There has been action in the courts going back now over a year to ensure some sort of judicial compliance with subpoenas involving emoluments. Certainly, there was a subpoena sent to Mr. Mulvaney. He's refused to comply. Mr. Bolton, who has testimony, has not been subpoenaed, but his deputy, Kupperman, has been. And we've gotten a few rulings in the lower courts that seem to say that they need to comply. On the other hand, it's going to take some time, weeks, if not months, before some of these things play out completely. These people have cover, political cover, if they want to come forward, for example, John Bolton, but they have not. I don't see many of these people willingly coming forward or these lawsuits being resolved anytime soon. Even if they are resolved, I think the risk that the House runs with this particular Supreme Court is the possibility of some adverse rulings. And so, you know, I think that it's kind of they're in a tight box. There's a window to run, especially those who think that this president has done something that is impeachable, and the moment to act is now.
I mean, is Congress powerless then?
They're not powerless, and one of the interesting things is it's sort of unfortunate that Professor Turley sort of indulged this sort of talking points by the Republicans as though the process is flawed and illegitimate. And I think that this is not true compared to how past impeachment proceedings have been run. The Republicans have been able to ask questions. Those closed hearings were like the equivalent of depositions in a regular court. And it's about securing testimony when people's memories are fresh. And making sure people don't coordinate their stories. This was very important, for example, in forcing Ambassador Sondland to tell the truth. The first time he gave a closed deposition, he left out a lot, what we might call material omissions. Yeah. And then there were contradictions by other witnesses, meetings he conveniently forgot, didn't mention, and other people swore up and down they had conversations with him. And so this is how the process should work in an orderly way. So now, are they powerless? I think that one interesting thing is that some of Professor Turley's concerns can be dealt with once we move to the Senate side, because it's very easy for any senator to request a subpoena. You know, the president's lawyers will have that opportunity. The House managers who will act as prosecutors will be able to compel testimony or gain documents if they want. And the key there will be that a mere majority of the vote, which is controlled by the Republicans, will be able to get any piece of information they want. So they're going to get every bit of due process they've been claiming for and more on the Senate side.
And this is, I mean, we're all learning things because this doesn't happen very often in American history, David, which is the House, is that sort of like a grand jury, and the Senate is where the trial takes place? Is that a helpful way to think about this?
Yeah, this is one of the most basic misunderstandings about this process that I think actually a lot of people are coming to learn about over the past couple months, which is great as a constitutional law professor. We like when people start learning these things, that the impeachment process technically is the House of Representatives brings the charges by voting on impeachment. But being impeached does not remove someone from office. It takes the Senate trial, which is like the real trial in a criminal case, to actually remove. And that requires 2/3 of a vote. And as Robert
just
said, that's a high bar. And as Robert just said, the Republicans control the Senate. You would need 20 Republicans to join with all of the Democrats and democratically identified independents to get to that 67 vote level. And that's really difficult. That's one of the protections the Constitution puts in to the impeachment process to make sure it's not abused, to make sure that any impeachment to actually remove someone from office requires this supermajority vote.
And does it explain why that's never happened?
I mean, we came one vote short with President Johnson, with the first president who was impeached, and then in his trial in the Senate, he fell one vote short. President Clinton, who was impeached as well, fell, I believe, 17 votes short on one charge, 12 votes short on another. So we have never had this happen. I mean, we might have gotten there with President Nixon, but he saw the writing on the wall and resigned.
And that's David S. Cohen joining us along with Robert Tsai talking about what happened yesterday at the House Judiciary Committee. Also, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's announcement this morning about impeachment going forward and what the Constitution says. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with David S. Cohen. He's a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, teaches constitutional law and related topics. Robert Tsai with us as well, professor of constitutional law at American University and an expert on the presidency. Let me read a couple of comments here, and then I want to play the final clip that we have from law professor Michael Gerhart. An email from Frank. He says, in general, the Republicans on the committee who tried to disrupt, distract, and even generate boredom clearly know that the facts are not on Trump's side. Why are the Republicans still on Trump's side, he wonders. Evelyn wrote on our Facebook page, the Republican-invited professor, that would be Turley, was arguing the issues based on a constitution he'd like to see versus how it's actually written. For example, he'd like to see a slower process because speed harms the case. Well, that's not written anywhere. A question from Dave. Trump tweeted this morning that the Senate will call witnesses such as Joe and Hunter Biden and Adam Schiff. Can the Senate call these witnesses? Are they required to testify? I'm interested in that last question, and perhaps, Robert, I'll toss that first to you. Assuming the House votes for impeachment and it moves on to the Senate, who is required to testify there, or who can defy a subpoena, or can they?
There's not a requirement anywhere in the Constitution that the Senate do anything other than to hold a trial. If there were 51 votes, for example, to end the proceeding, to grant, say, the president's defense lawyers a motion to dismiss the articles of impeachment, and they could get 51 votes for that, the proceeding would be over. There's been some conversation about this already. There were reports that at a meeting at the White House, senators had discussed this. And so there are some who don't want that impression, that they think that this is not in the interests of the Republican Party to look like they're sort of whitewashing everything that the president has done. So I think that's probably the major political constraint on not doing something like that. Now, as far as whether anybody has to actually show up, if they're asked to show up, if assuming we actually have some semblance of a proceeding, you know, I think a lot of the documentary evidence will just be brought over. There's no expectation that even the House managers will ask anybody in particular to testify live, unless there's something new that could be added. You know, so I think you'll hear presentation by the prosecution side. There's a question of whether the House managers want to try to get a subpoena to get someone like Bolton or Mulvaney to testify, or at least to force the senators to be on the record on such a motion. And that might be something that we can watch for. If that succeeds, then, you know, we would have this interesting moment where, you know, what will the president do? And that's a moment that will be quite interesting if we cross that bridge.
David, let me put this question to you from a listener. Does your guest think Joe Biden broke any laws when he bragged about holding back the $1 billion for Ukraine? This is when Joe Biden was the Obama administration's point person for Ukraine, and he was criticizing the prosecutor there. And he did, I guess, brag is a pretty correct word. He did brag about it. Is that sort of like what Trump did, or is that something different?
No, that's different. My understanding of that was that he wanted the prosecutor to be more vigilant with investigating corruption, and that he was not trying to hold back any. And this was Ukrainian corruption, not by any American citizens, having nothing to do with the American election. He was not trying to have any prosecutor soft pedal an investigation into his son. It was quite the opposite. So it's completely different. That being said, if the Republicans were really concerned about that, they controlled the House of Representatives for 6 of President Obama's 8 years in office. They could have investigated it then. They had 2 years that they controlled the House in the beginning of Trump's presidency. They could have investigated Vice President Biden then. They didn't. This is a straw man they're creating to prop up something that they're trying to say, well, both sides do it. Both sides don't do this. This is sui generis that President Trump is trying to use a foreign power to investigate a political rival.
Let me play one more clip. And again, this is University of North Carolina law professor Michael Gerhart. This is part of his opening statement yesterday, and his testimony was steeped in the history of impeachment, including the proceedings against President Richard Nixon.
The gravity of the president's misconduct is apparent when we compare it to the misconduct of the one president who resigned from office to avoid impeachment, conviction, and removal. The House Judiciary Committee in 1974 approved 3 articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon, who resigned a few days later.
Robert, I'm just curious. We have Richard Nixon, who obviously resigned before impeachment. We've also got President Clinton, who was impeached but held on to his job as a result of the trial in the Senate. Are there lessons that we can learn from either of these two cases?
Well, I think that from where I'm standing, there's actually a legitimate criticism of the framers, that they were certainly thinking big, but they were constrained by the circumstances of their time. And they really had a lot of faith in Americans kind of rising above partisan differences. And there's a sense in which they might not have been able to envision fully what we've become today. And so if you follow this kind of train of thought, then it's possible that the framers have created a remedy that is in practice either extremely difficult or impossible to actually complete. Mm. We've never actually, right, successfully removed a president. We've removed other people, other officials. But there's something about the presidency and the way that it's grown as well that has made it much, much harder, even when it seems clear as day that the president has done something wrong. Now, in Nixon's case, he was moved by members of his own party who walked down Pennsylvania Avenue and convinced him to resign for the good of the country and for the good of the party. I don't think we'll see that today in the same way. And that it tells us something about the way partisan differences have hardened in a way, I think, that might have made impeachment, and we'll see, but no longer truly an effective thing for removing a president, but instead as something as a kind of a super censure to really kind of express strong moral disapproval of the president's actions and something that should hang around that president's neck for the rest of history.
David and I were talking before going on the air, and I said, you know, this is my third impeachment. I was there for the Nixon impeachment, for the Clinton impeachment, and also now for the Trump impeachment. The question being, there was an impeachment in back in the 19th century, and then three in the last 40 years or so, whether this is going to become kind of business as usual. What do you think, David?
On the one hand, I mean, it's undeniable that there have now been three in 45 years, and that's concerning on a constitutional level. It makes you wonder if it will, you know, become par for the course going forward. But on the other hand, I think there's a stronger argument to be made that we have three pretty exceptional situations here. If you look at President Bush II and President Obama, both held office for 8 years, both highly contentious presidents. One took us into war in a very controversial way. Another one was investigated endlessly for things that he did or didn't do, but things that the opposition party thought he did. And both of them had years in their term where the House was controlled by the opposing party. And yet we didn't have impeachment proceedings. The Republicans never brought impeachment proceedings against President Obama. The Democrats never brought impeachment proceedings against President Bush. They could have. They didn't, because they understood that this is something you don't do just because you have political disagreement, even strong political disagreement with the president. This is something saved for extraordinary actions. So, yes, this has come more often in the past 45 years, but I don't think it's because of it's being used too often.
Let me read some more comments from our email bag here. We've got a question from David. I understand there's a recording of the conversation between Trump and the Ukraine president when Trump was asked for a favor. When Trump asked for a favor, why can't that recording be evidence? Robert, can you take that?
Well, the recording can be evidence.
This is the one that was put into the super secret safe, I guess, in the White House.
Well, what we have is we've got a recording, and then we've got the printed readout that was sort of written and that was edited to some degree as the sort of the testimony of the NSC staff later revealed. Yes, this all can be put into evidence to the extent that they can get their hands on that recording. So, that's something that we can sort of keep our eye out for is, you know, what else the House managers might try to do, what's worth doing once we move to the Senate side.
David says, David, our listener says, the reason we're in this situation is because Nancy Pelosi didn't impeach Bush and Cheney for lying about weapons of mass destruction, speaking to what you were just saying there. David, Joe says, so if the House votes to impeach and the Senate votes to remove from office, what happens if a sitting president refuses to accept those results and refuses to leave? Who actually removes him or her? David?
I think this is one of the easier answers in my mind. The Constitution doesn't say the person who is the president. It depends on where they are, like physically. If President Trump refused to leave, say, the Oval Office or the West Wing, that wouldn't make him president. The Constitution is clear. If you're removed from office, you're no longer the president. And I would assume, the good faith of everyone acting within the United States government and the military and other branches of government, that they would no longer recognize him as president, whether or not he insisted he was still president.
So he could be in the White House.
You know, he's trespassing at that point. He's not the president. He shouldn't be there. But even if he insists on staying, the Constitution is clear. The vice president is now the president. President Pence will be the one who controls the executive branch of the government. And Citizen Trump is not the president, whatever he says. So he can put up a fight in that regards, but if he's removed from office, he's no longer the president, the vice president, Mike Pence is.
Robert, there was a lot of talk yesterday about bribery, what the founders and what the framers intended when they wrote bribery into the Constitution, and then how that word is changed over time. How should we understand it in light of this particular case?
This is an interesting question. It's clear that the framers listed two specific things that they thought that beyond all doubt would be grounds for impeachment, and that's treason and bribery. No one thinks that anything that the president has done would rise to the level of treason, either defined in a kind of original constitutional sense or under existing federal criminal law. Bribery is the one that's interesting, and some people have also thrown in the possibility of extortion as something that could be close to bribery, but qualify as well as a high crime or misdemeanor. The way that the experts have talked about it is that asking for something of value in this way, kind of corruptly doing so, and this is kind of a adjustment to the president's sort of situation, but kind of corruptly misusing his office to ask for something of value for his own personal advantage. This is the kind of language I think that the experts used, as well as the sort of House Democrats, the Judiciary Committee. They've all sort of kind of gravitated this language as the best way of encapsulating how this could be either bribery or extortion. There is a kind of a question that's been hanging out there, one that certainly Professor Turley underlined, which is, does it have to formally meet all of the elements of bribery in current criminal law? And Professor Feldman pushed back on that and sort of said, hey, look, it's not defined in the Constitution, even though it's mentioned. And if the Senate ultimately says that what the president did was bribery in a constitutional sense, that would trump any kind of competing notions of bribery in the statutory sense.
I mean, David, this is when it's sometimes difficult to understand that impeachment is a political process, but it does involve the Constitution. It does involve our laws. And I think as a non-lawyer, it's sometimes confusing what that actually means.
I think we want to look to the Constitution and find some very specific answers to the questions we're raising. If the president disobeys a subpoena, or if what is bribery? The Constitution is a short document that doesn't have a lot of these answers. Some of the answers are very clear. You need 2/3 to remove someone from office. The president has to be 35. Some of the parts of the Constitution are very clear, but a lot aren't. And I think that was part of what the framers wanted. They wanted some of these things to be left in the hands of the political process, the people who are representing the people and the states, to figure this out, hopefully come to a resolution and reach this high bar to agree that what we have here is an abuse of office for personal gain. And we need a majority in the House and 2/3 in the Senate to understand that that's what happened and convict based on it with these words that are not defined. We have some historical sense what they mean, but they are also left to current political actors to flesh out what that means.
Robert, we're almost out of time, but I'm thinking of the Clinton impeachment and then what happened under Nixon, and what a test these proceedings are for our country, whether it is about government or the courts or even the media. And if I can just give you 30 seconds just to opine about that.
Absolutely. I just want to go back to a point that I made before, which is this concern that perhaps that the framers overlooked just how much of a problem partisanship is and how hard it is it might be for us today to rise above that and think about what's good for the country as a whole. If we compared to the movement of popular support for the impeachment of President Trump, we're actually ahead of where people were, for example, when it came to Nixon. A little bit of research tells us that even after the Saturday night massacre, support for removing Nixon stayed very, very low. It doesn't even cross 50% until the House Judiciary recommends the impeachment of the president. We're well ahead of that right now. On the other hand, there's this paradox, because it's not clear that we'll actually decide to remove this president.
Well, to be continued, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Time. Robert Tsai, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And he's a professor of constitutional law at American University, joined us from the NPR studios in Washington. And David S. Cohen, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you. He's a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.